This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Every magazine, television show, radio show, and online site is going to be looking back on 2011 this week. There'll be top 10 lists, earnest profiles of heroes and do-gooders, comedic renditions of the year's most iconic moments in politics, sports, entertainment, and the news. Well, we here at the State of Things will have none of that. We're not going to indulge in that cheap form of filling airtime. No end-of-the-year cliches for us. Instead, we're going to bring you something new and exciting. And here to tell us all about it is State of Things senior producer Susan Davis. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Frank.
So what have you and the team come up with for this week between Christmas and New Year's? When everyone else is looking back, we're going to be looking forward. We're going to zig when everybody else zags.
No. Sorry. We're going to rely on the clip show chestnut like everybody else. But, you know, ours will be better. And you want to know why, Frank?
Why is that?
Because we're better.
I'm so disappointed.
I know. I'm sorry.
The cheesy clip show. We're going to do it. But let's get on with it now because it can be fun.
It's going to be fun. We are going to make it fun.
All right.
We are fun.
What have you got?
Well, I'm going to start with a conversation we had with Rob Dunn. He's an ecologist and evolutionary biologist at NC State. And he wrote a book. First of all, I love the title of the book. The book's called The Wild Life of Our Bodies. Then there's that scientific subtitle, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. He's a very articulate and funny guy, and he makes science accessible to poets like me. And, you know, North Carolina in general, but the Triangle specifically, is home to many scientists who do all kinds of life-affirming and life-changing research. And it can be a challenge to have them on because a lot of our listeners, and I include myself, are really smart, educated, articulate people, but they don't they're not agile with scientific language, and so they can get lost. But Rob's not that guy.
I know. And also has a healthy sense of humor, which we also appreciate in a guest. So let's listen to Rob Dunn talking here about many species that live in and on our bodies and how our immune systems respond to that fact.
And so one really interesting body of work comes out of a guy named Bill Parker, who's at Duke University. And Parker was supposed to be working on something a few years ago called xenotransplantation, where you take an organ from one organism and put it into another. And a lot of difficulties there, but one is the human antibodies that try to kick that organ out. And so he started working on the antibodies, thinking about them, and he found an old literature about an antibody called IgA, which it turns out is the most common one in our guts. And that literature suggested that that antibody is the bacteria butt-kicking antibody. That's its primary role. But the weird thing about it was when he looked at that antibody and then at the bacteria seemed to have essentially a receptor for the antibody, as though they had a door for it. And so it really challenged what he thought, and he started to think about this. And long story short, what he came to realize and what's come to be part of the sort of main literature on the subject is that our antibodies were actually helping those bacteria. And so
I got to stop you there now because we think of antibodies are precisely the thing that identify the other. And as you say, go out and get it, right? And now we're finding, but not – wait a minute. It identifies it and assists?
Yeah, so I think it's better in a way to think about our immune system not as attacking the other, but as identifying good and bad, and then as a function of that information, deciding how to respond. And a big part of the way that our immune system seems to respond to what's living on our bodies is by helping a lot of it. One of the really interesting things is if you look at your sweat's full of amino acids, especially leucine. And so the question becomes, well, why is it there? What's it doing there? It's a costly thing. We eat food to get those amino acids. Well, nobody knows. No one's really looked at it. But it's conceivable that those same amino acids, which are part of what's feeding the bacteria on your body, are actually being produced for those bacteria. And so really, we're kind of in the dark ages of understanding what lives on us and how it influences us. And yet, even as we're ignorant, we go on living with these other species. I mean, as I wave my hands around, I know I'm on the radio, but I forget, my hands are covered with hundreds of other species.
Why aren't they? Aren't they just incidental? I mean, I wash my hands to get those species off so I don't get sick. That's what I think I'm doing with the other species. But you're saying some of those things are beneficial. They should be there.
That's right. So if you really scraped all of the bacteria, fungi, other things off of your body, you would get sick and you would very likely die. And that would happen in part because one of the main things those bacteria are doing is acting as a kind of first line of defense. And so when a pathogen shows up, they help to defend you against that pathogen. They're kind of a bodily garden, and helping to keep the weeds out. And so they play this really important role.
So it's like mercenaries. There is probably no great – you are a tremendous authority on this. But I think the ultimate authority, of course, is the cartoon show The Simpsons. And so we're gonna go to The Simpsons now to illustrate, I think, what you're saying. And this, of course, the ancient Mr. Burns goes to the doctor, has a battery of tests, and as far as he's concerned, he has come through swimmingly. He's very proud of himself, and here's how it goes.
You may shake my hand if you like.
Well, under the circumstances, I'd rather not.
Eh?
Mr. Burns, I'm afraid you are the sickest man in the United States. You have everything.
You mean I have pneumonia?
Yes.
Juvenile diabetes?
Yes.
Hysterical pregnancy?
A little bit, yes. You also have several diseases that have just been discovered in you.
I see. You're sure you just haven't made thousands of mistakes?
No, I'm afraid not.
This sounds like bad news.
Well, you'd think so, but all of your diseases are in perfect balance.
So there might be something to that, that we actually have mercenaries fighting little wars for us.
No, and I mean, I think that clip is great. I got to stop smirking so I can talk. But it's great for a number of reasons. One is that we've been doing all this sampling of people's belly buttons and what lives in belly buttons. And it's really, on the one hand, very silly. You know, the belly button is potentially the silliest part of our body. And yet it's an interesting part of our body because it's kind of on reserve. It's a conservation area that we don't scrub quite as well. And so we now know from genetic data which species of bacteria are living in the belly buttons of all sorts of people we've sampled. And I know what was living on me, for example. And in part, it's a combination of these things that we think of as good bacteria and then all of these kinds of crazy bad things that are kind of fighting it out with the good bacteria. And I would have never known we're there except that we happened to take this sample.
Well, and you've actually discovered brand new species, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've sampled about 500 people so far, but we've done the genetics on about 90, and this is work led by Yuri Holzer and Andrea Lucky in my lab, who are both just covered in bacteria, and so from those 90 people, 90 humans. We have 1,400 species of bacteria, and this isn't like a scouring of their whole bodies and their guts and everything. This is from one Q-tip swab of their belly buttons, and there's no reason to believe we're even close to having all the bacteria you would find in their bodies. And the sense of what part of what's going on in the skin is that you have these common things, these core things that are doing good, and then you have all this other stuff that shows up. And for example, I did a sample on my forehead, one of the things that turned up that day in the sample of my forehead is a bacteria that's only known to eat pesticides. And so either I'm using the wrong kind of shampoo or I happened to have bumped into a plant that day because I also had pollen on my head. And so there's all this stuff that's bumping into you, all this stuff that's on you in a given moment. And most of that we never hear from, so to speak.
But again, getting back to these amino acids, it's not all incidental contact. Some of this stuff may have been nurtured. Our own bodies may say, look, we need something as a front line of defense in case, rather than wait until we're infected. Let's feed these things. They fight the very bacteria that are enemies to us.
Yeah, and I think it's more and more clear that in our guts we are feeding these things, both by the food we eat and these antibodies, which what they're doing is to help some of these bacteria to form what are called biofilms. And biofilms are these amazing things. When they're on your teeth, you don't like them. It's what makes plaque. But it's kind of a mutualism between – it is a mutualism between many species living together in a kind of layer. And if you don't form a biofilm in the gut, what happens is you get washed out not get too visual a couple of times a day.
That's the antibiotics phenomenon. We all know that. We've taken a course of antibiotics and it ends up with a very unpleasant a very unpleasant side effect because we've wiped out some good guys who have been at war with bad guys and we don't even know it. Then the bad guys take over because we lost the good guys and we spend a little more time in the commode.
Yeah, and we imagine the antibiotics, whether we're talking about these oral antibiotics that save our lives and have saved millions of lives, or we're talking about things like antimicrobial soaps and wipes, we imagine that they're really specific, that scientists, being much smarter than anyone ever on The Simpsons, figured out these things that target the bad things, kill them, and leave us wonderful and healthy. But the truth is, I mean, most antibiotics are kind of like a giant hammer you swallow. The hammer sort of bangs around in your gut, knocks a bunch of stuff down, and if you're lucky, it knocks the bad stuff down. But it also hits all kinds of other things. And so we're really still at a very primitive stage when it comes to dealing with these species that are on us.
That is NC State ecologist and biologist Rob Dunn talking about the wildlife of our bodies. And Susan, do you ever find that the show sometimes makes you a little freaked out? I mean, finding out about some of these things, some of the stuff that lives in us and on us, on our body, can be a little disconcerting.
Yeah, it's the burden of information. You know, it can be hard to know what you and I know.
Even harder to find out what we don't know. Speaking of which, when we get back after a short break, we're going to hear from a show we did on the literature of forgetting. Our senior producer, Susan Davis, is here. She's making me do a week of clip shows. Her favorites will continue in a moment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. State of Things senior producer Susan Davis is with me in the studio today, and we're going to do our annual Totally Predictable and What Else Did You Expect Week of Staff Favorites today.
And, you know, Frank, since you're so unhappy with the predictability of this show, I'm going to go ahead and spring a little surprise on you.
That's actually my cell phone.
Yeah.
Can I? Hi. Hello. Well, I'm fine, except I forgot to turn my cell phone off in the middle of this interview. Yeah. Yeah. So can I call you back?
Oh,
I'm going
to Trader Joe's.
Call me
when you're ready.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
It's my wife.
We need milk. We need.
No, I do. It is Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
But I'll have to call her while she's there.
Okay. Okay. I'll talk fast.
I didn't turn it off. I just closed the
I noticed
thing.
That. I was like, are you going to turn it off?
No, I'm going to just see if I close this. Magically, it won't ever do that again.
Okay. So I don't know where I was.
I don't know either.
Should I just start telling the story of the
song? So where was
again?
She?
So that was during an interview with the lovely and gracious Laura Lynn Dossett. And luckily it was taped because we do 95% of the show live, but occasionally we have to tape with people who aren't available during the noon hour. And Laurelyn was doing an original song cycle with the North Carolina Symphony not that long ago, and she came by with her guitar and her friend, the talented Rhiannon Giddens of Carolina Chocolate Drops, to give us a preview. And your phone goes off.
Exactly. And here's the thing. My phone is always on and in my pocket, and that shows you how often people call me. And it just turned out – cashews, by the way, the other thing that Joanne got at Trader Joe's. Anyway, you saved the piece of tape, of course, and it's particularly funny because we make a point of asking everybody else on the show, and it never occurs to me to shut mine off when I tell them to do theirs. And they, of course, do. They – or leave them in the green room, and they're all very obedient except for me.
Yeah. And I really, though, saved that piece of tape because, really, you were quite poised and self-deprecating through it. And I thought it was a good lesson for anyone planning to be on the radio in how to cope – should a cell phone go off during your segment? And, you know, it's me that you were talking to at the end when you asked, so where was she? And honestly, it was not my best moment as a producer because I was so enjoying the fact that your cell phone had gone off during a segment that I totally lost track and I couldn't really answer your question. It took us a little while to recover. So it was one of those particularly human moments in the making of this show.
Well, it was great. And it did. Luckily, as you say, we were on tape. So thank you for that surprise. And I'm thinking maybe that the tried and true clip show isn't such a bad idea after all. Now, what else do you want to talk about?
I want to play a clip from a show we did on Alzheimer's disease and the literature around it. We asked Dr. James Burke, who's the director of the Memory Disorders Clinic at Duke, to explain the disease for us medically and clinically. And then we invited a young novelist named Stephen Merrill Block to talk about his book, which is called The Story of Forgetting. There have been a lot of nonfiction and self-help books about Alzheimer's disease ever since the disease was named. They've come out. But those are books chronicling someone's struggle or books about taking care of someone with the disease.
And you're talking about memoir and how-to books, not novels. But several literary critics recently started using the term Alzheimer's literature to describe the novels and poetry published in the last decade that deal with the epidemic of Alzheimer's.
And Stephen Merrill Block's book is exceptionally moving and inventive. And any conversation about Alzheimer's is emotionally charged because it's a dignity-robbing, protracted disease, and the suffering spreads from the patient to the family members and caregivers. And I thought that pairing this young novelist with Dr. Burke would bring some imagination to the conversation, since Stefan posits a whole made-up history for the disease.
So let's listen to Stefan Merrill Block and Dr. James Burke, and we're going to start with Stefan describing the main characters and the plot of his novel.
As a young boy and an old man, Seth is, you know, bears more than a passing resemblance to myself at 15. He's sort of a loner and a science nerd. And he is suffering. His mother is appears to be in the early stages of this terrible neurological condition, early onset Alzheimer's. Hundreds of miles away in Texas lives this old man named Abel. He's a 70-year-old, and he's sort of the sole survivor of this ancient family farm. When the book opens, you know, there's no obvious connection between the two, except for the fact that both Seth and Abel have dealt with the loss of loved ones to this terrible disease. And also, as children, both were told the stories of this land, this place called Isidora, sort of a fantastical other world, a place that exists without memory. And as the book goes on, their shared experience of the disease and these stories sort of guide their paths together.
And now tell us about Lord Alban Mapplethorpe.
So, the novel mostly deals in the present day, or the late 90s in Texas, with his family, but it also goes, hundreds of years back to the origin of this form of Alzheimer's. It's the sort of dominant early onset gene that Dr. Burr was describing earlier. So the book shifts backward in time to describe this Duke in England. He's a fictional creation, but based off of some historical people, but it was in his genetic material that the disease began, and he was a very prolific lover, a very powerful man in his town, and so he scattered his genetic material dandelion spore across England and then eventually across the world.
Now, this idea of his ability to get around, as it were, came to you because of some of the research you did on this gene, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that moved me the most as I was thinking, I have personal experience with Alzheimer's disease, which is why I chose to write a novel about it. My family has it's not exactly the form I describe in the book, but a very genetic form of a relatively early onset kind of Alzheimer's disease. I felt a kind of, I don't know if comfort is the right word, but a sort of sense of shared experience in thinking about all the generations of my family that have suffered from this disease. In some ways, it starts to feel like a familial rite of passage. And so as I was doing research about it, I was thinking about that, about this disease, but also about other genetic diseases, and especially when it's a single gene on a single chromosome, as it is in my novel, like with Huntington's disease, that all sufferers of this disease can be traced back to a single point of origin. There's something to me very moving about the idea that every sufferer of this disease, they're scattered across the world, they're suffering individually, but that they are all a part of a family. And to me, it held a very powerful metaphor about the nature of history and family, that you can run away from it, you can try to escape the burdens of the past, but in the case of your genetic heritage, your history in a very tangible and real way becomes your destiny.
Well, Stefan, will you read for us from your book?
Yeah, definitely. What I'm going to read is just a very short excerpt. It's from the book is basically written in two voices, Seth and Abel, and this is the old man, Abel, describing the loss of his mother to Alzheimer's disease. There's a concept called retrogenesis that I'm sure Dr. Burke can speak about more eloquently than I could, but the idea that Alzheimer's strips away your cognitive functions in essentially the opposite way of how a child's brain learns them. So the things that you learn latest as you are developing, you lose first in the disease. And so it sort of rewinds your brain back to infancy. So this is Abel describing his mother. Every reversal, every subtraction of memory was a little death. The border between the existent and the non-existent, so certain for most, was a thing Mama could cross carelessly, constantly. By the end of her life, her old soul had not so much vanished as eroded, worn away by a million rubs. I stopped praying. By the time Mama turned 18, all she had left was her name, which she would holler. "Sarah want," Mama would hoot, pointing at a jar of cookies. "Sarah tired," she would fuss in the afternoons. We were 19 when the disease commenced its final, irrevocable backward march, death finally coming for all that life first brings. The death of speaking, the death of walking, the death of control over the bowels, the death of standing upright, the death of self-feeding, the death of crawling, the death of sitting up, the death of sleeping at night, the death of swallowing. When the final death came, that of the beating of her heart, so much of her had died so long before that this death was no more than another, was simply the last. But at the end, modest solace. After countless deaths, after a full reversal of a life, what was left of Mama finally came to rest in the fragile circle of an unborn baby, her emaciated knees drawn snugly to her chest. The only word for her then was not dead, but returned.
Stephen Merrill Block reading from his novel, The Story of Forgetting. We're talking about Alzheimer's today on The State of Things. Dr. James Burke, this progress of the disease, which seems universal once it's been diagnosed, it may not tell us much about Alzheimer's. That's still a mystery. How much have we learned about memory as a result of watching this disease and studying it?
We've learned a lot. The structures that are responsible for memory, the various components that contribute to memory, the key role for attention in terms of maintaining and laying down new memories. So it has been really instructive in terms of our basic understanding.
That's writer Stephen Merrill Block and Dr. James Burke talking about Alzheimer's disease. Senior producer Susan Davis is sharing her favorites today. And Susan, you produced the show about the literature of forgetting partly because you have a personal interest in Alzheimer's disease, having lost your father to it, but not all of your favorites are shows that you produced.
Right. And in fact, most of my favorites this year are from shows produced by other members of the staff. And as a senior producer, I take incredible pride in that. I think the staff of The State of Things is really talented, and I'm consistently delighted with their ideas and their work, and I'm really happy to showcase their work and your work, frankly, on my favorites today.
Well, that can also be said for the people in the state who regularly contribute ideas to the program. One of those is Mark Anthony Neal, a professor at Duke in the African and African American Studies Department. He does a wonderful podcast called Left of Black. And he told us about a writer named Steve Stout who is coming to town and would be a guest on Left of Black.
And we had Steve Stout on ahead of his visit to Left of Black. We had him on to talk about his book, The Tanning of America. And the book is about hip-hop culture and its effect on race relations in America. He starts with a conversation about marketing and the marriage of celebrity and product, the most famous being Run DMC and Adidas. But he was clear that he wanted to talk about hip-hop culture, not hip-hop music.
So let's listen to Steve Stout, author of The Tanning of America, talk about the role of hip-hop culture and the role that it played in the election of President Barack Obama.
25 years ago, if an African-American would have ran for president, regardless of what his resume would have been, he would have been discounted immediately at the ballot. He would have been discounted. There's no way. And I believe a generation grew up looking at the world much differently, saying, you know what, why not an African-American candidate? And I believe that hip-hop has caused so many people to come together because they could find something that's shared upon culturally. And they grew up together saying, this is the way we see the world. We see the world through a very similar lens. And music fortunately brought that and made that happen without pushing it down. It wasn't a preachy thing. It was much more of an organic relationship of people coming together. And I believe that coming together allowed white Americans, college students, young adults to have a very open mind at an African-American president. And that's what, A, got them out to vote, and B, put him in office.
Why do you think something rooted in African-American culture is that thing that brought that allowed for that confluence and now resonates worldwide so deeply with so many people?
Well, it just happened to be an art form that African-Americans created. I don't think that it's because it's African-American did it do that. I will say that why it stuck and why it had so much global appeal is because it sort of, in a weird way, contemporized the American dream. You know, when we all came over here, when You know, the Americans first came over here from Europe. The American dream was about putting your stake in the ground, getting some real estate, getting your farm, you know, and building and cultivating a life for you and your family. And I feel like that message needs to be contemporized. And when you got kids growing up in all these inner cities around America and around the world, and for the first time there was an art form that said, we're going to celebrate the fact that we came from nothing. We're going to not hide from this. We're going to be very unapologetic about we came from nothing and that we want something. And hip-hop music and the culture celebrated that.
Yeah, but it seems like there are two distinct strands. One, the strand that you just described, an aspiration to equal opportunity and mobility. But another that kind of gets back to what you said earlier, shortcuts the process, and that is to take on the badges of material success, consumerism, taken to the nth degree. Is that also embedded in this aspiration that's part of hip-hop culture?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's not even part of hip-hop culture. It's, you know, when you're oppressed, Frank, the first thing you look for is a badge that says, I'm on my way. When you walk around and you see, you know, whether it's Russia and people who came out of Russia, since that's now become much more democratized and people get a chance there's a middle class now. It's less of the have than the have nots. You look at these people who went from poverty to middle class, they're running around with Louis Vuitton bags. They're running around with, you know, items that brandish, I've made it. The same thing with the Chinese. The same thing with Indians. Same thing with African Americans. When you come from oppressed places, you want to find badges that says, I'm on my way. I've made it. It may be a human reaction. It may just be a natural thing that comes from being oppressed for so long and wanting to say that I'm on my way. And I think that there's a side of it, yes, that can go too far and it could send the wrong signals. And I'm not saying that that's not necessarily right. What I'm saying is those badges are there and that it's to actually measure your gauge and aspiration and say, look, I aspire for this. This represents making it to me. This represents the road to going where I want to go. And I want to show the world that I'm on my way. And I can't not escape discussing that because some people look at hip hop culture and the videos and say all it does is celebrate spending money on cars, champagne and women and boozing and this, that and the third. But yet it gets lost the perspective in which they're coming from. And why they feel the way they feel about aspirational goods and the message that they're truly trying to say outside of just blatant, you know, wasting of money or spending money foolishly.
Do you think hip-hop culture itself is now finally getting its due recognition? It's being studied in the academy. Are we coming to a better understanding of the depth and the importance of hip-hop culture, do you think?
I think the culture is being much more understood. There's a generation that grew up on it. And if we get, as I'm so happy that, Frank, we can discard the music. Because if we talk about the music, it's ridiculous if we talk about the words, the language, what song is good, what song isn't good, which song has the right message or not. That's not what I want to get into because that's up to the artist and that's neither here nor there. But the culture itself, it's no different than the culture that came out of the 60s going into the 70s. When you talk about the baby boomers and Generation X, and the conflict and tension that those two generations went through. Now we have this generation, which is the hip-hop generation of the millennials, dealing with Generation X. And what does that look like? And I think that that's a very fair tension. And it shows evolution and it shows growth. And that hip-hop is being the music and sort of the backdrop and the soundtrack of that millennial generation.
And Frank, I want to say that I love Steve Stout's voice. It's deep, it's rich, it's expressive, and it's really clearly well located in New York. And listening to him is a great example for me of the simplistic beauty of radio, because not only is he saying something interesting, but it's like music when he speaks. There's a percussive element to his voice and a harmonic element, and it reminds me why I love my job.
Well, that segment was a favorite of mine, too, for many of the same reasons. Also because it illustrates how rich the cultural life of this community is. And actually, how many fascinating people come to town and luckily drop by our show first. I'm talking with State of Things senior producer Susan Davis about some of her favorite moments on the show from this past year. When we return, we will revisit Halloween with Southern Culture on the Skids. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking this hour with Susan Davis, the senior producer of the State of Things, kicking off our annual Staff Favorites Week. All right, Susan, we've talked about bacteria, interrupting cell phones, Alzheimer's disease, and race relations, which brings us to
music.
That's right. Every Friday, we have a live music show, wide variety of music, because we like to please everybody. And I know that you're a good sport about that. You have only issued one moratorium on the banjo in your 7 years. I've overridden those. And yet, we do it. And it is a wide variety of music. But there is a music that you do prefer.
It's true. I'm an alt-country folk kind of girl. Although at 14, my heart belonged to Jimmy Page. So I believe in rocking with conviction. But when I was in graduate school in Houston in the early 90s, there was a Chapel Hill band called Southern Culture on the Skids. They used to come to town often, and they would just take the roof off every place they played. There was always food involved in their shows and, of course, plenty to drink and an extremely colorful crowd, which was very welcome in a corporate town like Houston. So I didn't produce this next segment with them, but I was in a really great mood when they came to play some spooky music for us on the Friday before Halloween.
Let's listen to Southern Culture on the Skids on the State of Things.
This is Zombified.
On the Skids, live on the State of Things, Zombified from the album entitled The Same, and it is being reissued. They're going to play at Motorco tonight, but they're with us here today. Talked about this fact that you got together 20 years ago, get kicked out of the dorm or wherever you were.
I was an art student. Yeah.
Did you expect to be together this long? Was that what the plan when you got together?
Not really, but things just kind of happened for us and we just kind of kept rolling with it. I think our biggest goal when we started the band was not to be celebrities, get rich or anything, but it was to quit our day jobs. Mm-hmm. And we did that in 1991, so we hit success pretty early, you know?
That's pretty good. And what about art school? What were you planning to do if it hadn't been music?
Art. Painting.
Then you'd have a day job.
Yeah, I sure would.
That sounds great. What do you think accounts for that? Again, you didn't intend it. A lot of people that give their soul, and some have, to have a career in the music industry can't do it.
Well, I mean, I think we just kind of have a unique thing, you know? You got to come to us to get it.
How about if I come to you right now? Can I get you to play another
sure,
song?
Sure, sure, sure. This one's called She's My Witch.
Southern Culture on the Skids, She's a Witch. Southern Culture on the Skids, Dave Hartman on drums, Mary Huff on bass and vocals, Rick Miller on the guitar, and Tim Barnes on the guitar as well. And they are going to, that's from Zombified, newly reissued. They're going to be at Motoco tonight at 9. It's fun writing about zombies, isn't it? I mean, this is kind of a cool genre to write in.
You could do yeah, that. It really is. It really is. I mean, people are all honest about writing a Christmas record, but I got to say, Halloween records are more fun.
It's great stuff. Plus, you can play it when the kids come to the door and all that. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the first eight songs have Halloween soundtrack effects on them.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And we've got one called The Bats Are Sleeping that we actually got some of those cicadas that were here earlier this summer, the cycle. They were so loud out at the studio in the woods that it sounded like an alien spaceship was landing. So we did some of those, and my son sang the song Bats Are Sleeping in the Mary's iPhone, and then we mixed the two together, and that's actually on the record.
High tech and the undead. Yeah. It all yeah. comes together and zombified. Food's always been an important part of your shows. How did that all come together, the food and the...
Well, we had written a song in the early 90s called Eight Piece Box, and we were playing it at a Mexican restaurant in Harrison, Berg, Virginia. Was that it, Dave?
Yep.
And there was like four people at the show, three guys and one girl, and they were just trying to pick up this girl, right? They weren't paying any attention to us. We were playing on a stage by the front door. And the club owner had gotten us a bucket of chicken for our dinner buyout. And we hadn't had a chance to eat because we had hustled to get up there. And we're playing the song, and a homeless guy comes in through the front door and just reaches in the bucket, takes a piece of chicken, and starts eating it and staring at us. And I said, well, you know, we're working for that chicken. Why don't you get up here and do a little work with us? And he got up there and he just did kind of this homeless shuffle. I don't know what else you'd call it, but it was very entertaining. And all of a sudden, all the guys that were trying to like work on this girl, everybody was staring at the stage. And I thought, like, wow, well, you know, if a homeless fella can get the audience interested, just think what a pretty girl could do.
So and food has been part of the act ever since.
Yeah, we tried to stop doing it for a while because it got kind of old. But the fans just they mutinied on us and we caved in. It's always fun. It's like a chemistry experiment.
We do another song for us?
Yes. Yeah, this one here is a little bit different. You played it early on. It's called Bloodsucker. Let's see, it goes just like this. I said, hey, bloodsucker.
The band Southern Culture on the Skids with their song Bloodsucker, one of Susan Davis' favorites from 2011. Susan, anything else from this past year that you want to talk about before the hour's up?
Well, one of my favorite things about this past year is the fact that we started broadcasting every month from Triad Stage in Greensboro. It's been great to get out of the studio to meet listeners and bring the show to the Triad so we can present some of what's going on there from there. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that. And, of course, I really loved your brilliant discovery, the Jade City Pharaoh.
Well, it's just part of the richness of this area. Howard Kraft wrote that stage play that appeared at Man Bites Dog Theater. It was fantastic. The talented cast that he brought to the stage for the Jade City Chronicles was amazing. And he's agreed to write 11 episodes of the Jade City Pharaoh, making it the first African-American superhero radio series in America.
Mr. Jones, I just seen two U-Haul trucks pull up behind the courthouse.
And?
Men got out dressed like protesters, but they were carrying sticks with no signs attached, yo. Get what I'm saying?
They're gonna go into the crowd and start a fight. Man, discredit the whole rally.
Not on my watch.
Get that mother...
Get up.
All right, man.
Who sent you?
B.C.
The beef cooker? Why does he care about a labor rally?
Somebody paid him to. Look, man, I told you what you wanted. You gonna let me go?
Sure. Take that with you.
Oh, son! You see how Harold did him, son? Whoa!
Give me a sign, Preem.
Oh, so much for superhero neutrality.
Mr. Jones, you one bad motherfucker.
It certainly is exciting to put the Jade City Pharoah on the air.
Yeah, and nothing makes me happier than to think that we could nurture original content and creativity that way, and that it could spread, you know, and more people like Howard could come to us, and more people like Howard will happen around the state. I think it's the best news of 2011 is the Jade City Pharoah.
Thanks very much, Susan. It's been a great year, and looking forward to another great one in 2012.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our program or want to hear an archived edition, our website is stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.